This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of February 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. A pipeline through central Texas reignites the fight over land rights.
It's very clear that the people who live out here see this as an assault.
Does public comment before city council make a difference?
So it's not so much that there's no value to it, but by the time we get to Thursday, we've already heard it.
And the story of a man who robbed a bank so he could get health care in jail.
Because his eyesight was impaired, he couldn't get a new job, and he was running out of money.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
My family is prepared to fight this pipeline with all of our resources.
That was Lucy Johnson, former mayor of Kyle. Her family owns two ranches in Hays County, and she was speaking at a public meeting this week in Wimberley about plans to build a natural gas pipeline from the Permian Basin to the Gulf Coast. It's a 430-mile underground pipeline, and it would cut through the Texas Hill Country in Hays County. This pipeline is a byproduct of the unprecedented drilling boom in West Texas. There's just more oil and gas coming out of the ground than companies can ship to market. As KUT's Mose Bushell reports, this has reignited a long-standing debate over the rights of landowners in Texas.
The Hershey Ranch in Gillespie County out near Fredericksburg is a 1,500-acre span of rolling Texas hill country. Its sloping fields are dotted with trees, ponds, and historic structures dating back to the 1800s.
You know, as radio reporters, whenever we go to a place, we try to get whatever sound we can capture to kind of, you know, give the listeners a sense of where we are. But this ranch here is one of these spots where it's just so silent. There's really no sound to capture. Just a sense of remoteness and vast space.
By the end of the year, that silence could be broken, temporarily, by the sound of excavators and backhoes. That's because the Hershey Ranch is one of the properties that the pipeline is slated to run underneath. The company planning the project, Kinder Morgan, would also control about a 100-foot-wide swath of land above the pipeline.
And it'll go right through the heart of the ranch.
This is Andy Sansom. He owns this ranch. He's also one of Texas' most well-known conservationists. He was even once head of Texas Parks and Wildlife. He's especially upset about the pipeline because his ranch is private conservation land, where no development is supposed to happen. But, he says, his neighbors with properties that aren't designated for conservation don't want the pipeline either.
There are few parts of our state that are as iconic as the hill country. And it's very clear that the people who live out here see this as an assault.
That idea that the hill country may be too special, too, as Sampson says, iconic for this pipeline, is something you can expect to hear more of as the project gets underway. Kinder Morgan says it's willing to make small adjustments to the route, but the pipeline is coming.
I had someone say the other day, just move it 70 miles south and you'll have no problems.
Alan Fohr is a vice president for public affairs at Houston-based Kinder Morgan.
Well, I assure you that someone owns property 70 miles south, and there are other concerns and issues that would present themselves on any other significant reroute.
The thing is, in Texas, you kind of have to take the company's word on that. There's no public process, no oversight that happens before letters go out to property owners saying the pipeline's coming. And if a landowner doesn't want the pipeline, the company can take the land anyway, using a process called eminent domain.
One of the first questions we always get from a property owner is, how in the world can a private, for-profit pipeline company take my land?
Luke Ellis is a lawyer representing landowners, including Sansom, in their negotiations with Kinder Morgan. He says all a pipeline company has to do to claim the right to take land is fill out something called a T4 form and file it with the Texas Railroad Commission. That's the state's strangely named oil and gas regulator.
He said another way, you and I could form an LLC tomorrow and we could start to submit a T4 permit to the Railroad Commission saying that our LLC wants to build a private for-profit pipeline company. There's virtually no oversight there.
This is something that Texas has been grappling with in the courts and at the Capitol for decades. Every legislative session, it seems, lawmakers representing property owners file bills to overhaul the system. The oil industry and others that use eminent domain fight those efforts. In the end, nothing much changes.
I just think that there's a huge coalition of condemnors. These are the entities that take property that coalesce to lobby the legislature in a way where they do not want to change the framework.
And when these debates come up, the pipeline industry usually points out that using eminent domain is actually pretty rare. Kinder Morgan's Alan Foer says the company is right now working with landowners and trying to compensate them enough to satisfy them. He says the last thing a company wants are unhappy landowners.
Eminent domain is an absolute last resort. And that's not just some talking point that we came up with. That's reality. Because an adversarial relationship with a landowner that you cannot reach agreement with is an adversarial relationship that's going to be with you for a very long time.
But in some cases, an adversarial relationship is what happens. Back at the Hershey Ranch, Andy Sansom says he wants a change in state law to create more oversight on pipeline companies. And he says the time is right to do it.
I'm excited that it's got people stirred up out here. The people in the Hill Country are not happy about this.
And right down the road, a new legislative session is getting underway in Austin. Moz Bushel, KUT News.
If you are dreading the long wait involved with getting a new driver's license, you are not alone. KUT's Trey Sharp reports the Texas Department of Public Safety is having trouble keeping up with the growing demand.
DPS Director Steve McCraw went in front of the Texas Senate Finance Committee to lay out how much money the agency needs for patrolling the state, investigating crimes, and replacing vehicles worn out from extended deployments along the border with Mexico. But the main thing senators wanted to talk about is the growing crowds at driver license offices. They're hearing from constituents complaining about long waits and short-tempered employees. Senator John Whitmire is a Democrat from Houston. His approach to McCraw on the subject was direct.
Man, I'm here to tell you.
Fix it.
We need you to respond like your job depends on it. And I can't, you know, as a buddy of yours, I can't be more clear. I mean, we can't continue to meet like this.
McCraw said none of the state's driver license offices is fully staffed. They're having a hard time keeping employees because the pay is too low. He wants to hire more at higher pay because the state's population is projected to keep growing. Trey Shar, KUT News.
State lawmakers could soon change when you can buy liquor in Texas. KUT's Andrew Weber has more about a bill at the legislature filed last week.
The proposal would allow liquor stores to sell on Sundays. Right now, state law prohibits selling on Sundays and on certain holidays. The restriction has been on the books since 1961. The bill from State Representative Richard Pena Raymond would let stores sell from noon to 10 p.m. on Sundays. The Laredo Democrat says there's bipartisan support for the bill this session.
My guess is that a majority of the members in the House and a majority of the members in the Senate, if it got put to them, I think would be in favor of allowing those business owners to make the decision whether or not they want to open on Sunday, as opposed to government telling them that they have no choice.
The restriction is a vestige of so-called blue laws, which prohibited stores from selling specific items on weekends until they were mostly repealed in 1985. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
Austin's Historic Landmark Commission voted unanimously this week to designate Cisco's restaurant on East 6th Street as a historic landmark. If the city council gives its final approval, Cisco's would be eligible for property tax exemptions as long as the landmark is maintained. Haley Wilcox applied for the status with the blessing of the owner of Cisco's. She's with the historic preservation consulting firm OG.
The designation of this property is really important considering the rapidly changing landscape of East Austin. This is a way to preserve Hispanic heritage in East Austin and also bring the building's longstanding role in Austin's political history to the forefront.
Philanthropist and political activist Rudy Cisneros moved his bakery business into the Cisco's building in 1955, and that's what became Cisco's as we know it today. The structure itself was built in 1914 by J.B. Pierce and his brother Ben Pierce for their meat market. The Austin City Council held its first meeting of the year this week, and if you've ever watched a city council meeting, you might be familiar with the practice of public comment. People have a chance to weigh in on things before their elected officials vote. Sometimes issues are so popular or controversial, public comment can stretch for hours, late into the night. And that led KUT's Audrey McGlinchey to wonder, does it make a difference?
I've watched hours of city council meetings. I mean, it's my job. And sure, sometimes when citizen testimony rolls around, I feel like I'm watching an episode of the sitcom Parks and Recreation.
I have a few things I want to say about Laura Linney.
There is a disturbing lack of benches in Ramsett Park. I want to sit more.
I found a sandwich in one of your parks, and I want to know why it didn't have mayonnaise.
Not being completely fair, generally people in Austin make good, relevant comments.
A lot of people signed up to speak, over 300 citizens.
But I've always wondered, does any of this actually change an elected official's mind, or for that matter, their vote?
And the first person to speak who has 3 minutes is...
So I called up every city council office to ask.
So a time when you've gone into a city council meeting, planning to vote one way, then you've sat through something that someone said, and it either changed your vote or you decided to postpone it because you needed more time.
That is tough.
Councilmember Jimmy Flanagan represents far northwest Austin. He says it's pretty rare for him to decide how he'll vote during a council meeting. If it's a controversial issue, he knows where he stands going into the meeting. After all, he's gotten plenty of emails and phone calls beforehand.
So it's not so much that there's no value to it, but by the time we get to Thursday, we've already heard it.
But sometimes hearing it again does serve a purpose.
It was so powerful and so overwhelming to me, even though I'd already heard it.
That's Councilmember Greg Kassar. He told me about a time in 2016 when the city council was taking public comment on the city's budget. It's a chance for people to say, hey, spend some money on this thing I care about. This was the same year news broke that the city had a huge backlog of rape evidence kits that needed to be tested. A number of sexual assault survivors showed up to this meeting, including a woman named Marina Connor.
Hi, my name is Marina Connor, and I'm a third-year student at the University of Texas. And my rape kit has been in the backlog for 1 year and 22 days.
Connor told council members the story of how she was raped, held against the wall in a parking garage. She had been waiting more than a year for some closure.
I wake up every morning and think today's going to be the day that I get a call from my detective and that I get to move forward with this process. And so I'm just asking you to please help me get that phone call. Thank you.
Seemed like such a small ask that we could never heal or undo what's happened to her, but that she was just asking for us to raise our hands and vote for a budget amendment that would at least get it so that her detective would call her back.
Kassar already supported putting money into clearing the backlog, but he said Connor's testimony made it that much more imperative in his mind. Other council members mentioned this testimony as powerful and important, but their minds were already made up. In fact, none of the five council members I spoke to could give me an example of a time public testimony switched their vote. Some had gone into a voting session undecided, but picked a side based on new facts they learned. It turns out zoning cases, these often boring, sometimes minor situations, were the most common examples of this, council members told me. Why? Because sometimes these things are so technical, they have to figure them out in real time at the meeting.
Anybody sign up I didn't call? Council, we are now back up to the dais.
Mr. Mayor?
Sorry, you want to make a
motion? So I ask again, what is public testimony worth?
You're not just talking to the city council members, but you're talking to the public.
Eric Goff's a local activist. He testifies a lot in front of council, and he says it's often a way to find like-minded people.
You know, oftentimes people will testify, and then other people that are in the room will walk up and say, oh, we share this common value, and it's a chance to organize in the future.
Even if what citizens have to say isn't new to council members or won't change their minds, there's always the power of time. Hayden Blackwalker is an urban planner who often tells council members what she thinks, mostly about making the city's streets safer for cyclists and pedestrians. She says over time, she's seen some council members change their views,
take Councilmember Ann Kitchen. She sits on several transportation committees for the city.
I have seen her become more and more kind of adamant, more comfortable really advocating for streets that are safe for all people. And I think that that comes from the things that she's learned over time.
Walker says this is how she views public comment, as a big conversation happening over months and years.
It brings kind of a different perspective than what they get from their council staff or what they get from the transportation department staff or what they get from Capital Metro. You know, there are multiple perspectives that they're considering, and I think that's really important.
So when you're sitting through the next hours-long public comment session, think of it like watching a coast erode. It's not coming down with one wave, but if a bunch of waves keep hitting the shoreline over time, something's eventually going to budge. And remember, if you decide to get up there and speak your mind, nothing's off limits.
There's a sign at Rampsett Park that says, "Do not drink the sprinkler water." So I made sun tea with it, and now I have an infection.
Audrey McGlynn Shee, sir? KUT News.
Sir, are you listening to me, sir? Sir, I'm talking to you!
Kids who grow up in foster care and age out of the system before being adopted face a lot of challenges. They turn 18. They're out on their own. They don't have the support system most people have, and they're emerging from difficult adolescence, having grown up in different homes, attended different schools, not having a place to call home. Now, to make matters even worse, some kids age out of foster care without documentation, a birth certificate, a social security card, or a state ID. How could this happen? The Texas Standards Joy DS and Becky Fogel have been reporting on this issue for months, and they have a series about it next week on the Texas Standard, which you can hear weekdays from 10 to 11 on KUT. Joy and Becky, thank you for taking the time to talk to me about this.
Oh, thank you, Nathan, for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Nathan.
How could a child who has been under the care of the state age out of foster care and not have their personal ID?
Well, there's several circumstances. One could be that they were born out of state and perhaps their documents did not transfer. One could be that perhaps the parents left the hospital in a hurry. It happens, and a child may not even have a name. Forget about a birth certificate, may not even have a name. To make matters worse, when you are missing one document, it's really difficult to get another document. You need to have an ID. To get an ID.
When you say they may not have a name, what do you mean by that?
Yes, I know. It's hard to understand that a person cannot have a name. But sometimes, perhaps you were not born in a hospital, or perhaps, you know, you were born in the hospital, but your parents left without filling out the proper documentation. And the state still fills out the birth certificate, but they normally put in infant and the mother's last name. And that's your official name.
Wow. What kind of obstacles are created for young people who age out of foster care and don't have these documents?
It's hard for them to get a job. It's hard for them to get an apartment. If you've been through the foster care system in Texas, you're entitled to a tuition waiver for state-supported universities and colleges. If you don't have identification, you're not going to be able to take advantage of that huge benefit. And we heard that sometimes if you don't have identification, it leaves you vulnerable to dire situations such as human trafficking because you don't have a legitimate way to make a living. So these really basic things that we expect kids, you know, born in the United States who are entitled to documentation to be able to access, now they have barriers in their way and they've just come out of the foster care system.
And you know, Nathan, sometimes we don't think about it, right? Because it's second nature to just pull out your ID if somebody asks for it. But I did an experiment of several days I carried my recorder just to see how many times a day I was asked to provide my ID, you know, and things as simple as going to the outlet stores. You know, they ask for your identification before you pay.
To make a credit card purchase, right?
To make a credit card purchase. Or things as simple as renewing your passport. Not getting a passport for the first time. Renewing my passport. I needed to provide identification. So things that are second nature to those of us who are documented, for lack of a better word.
Right. Now, 1,200 young people age out of foster care each year in Texas. the state must have been able to tell you how many of those people don't have the proper documentation.
Actually, no.
So we did reach out to the Department of Family and Protective Services about this topic, and they did share with us in a statement that at this time, it's not something they currently track, though they did acknowledge that they do know that this happens, that there are kids for a variety of reasons who exit the system without one or three of these sort of what we're calling the big three, a birth certificate, a social security card, or a state identification card. The state is not required to make sure that they have a driver's license, but they are required to make sure they have a state identification card. They weren't able to provide a number at this time, though they did say they actually are in the process of changing their database to be able to start tracking when this is and isn't happening, because they do recognize it's an issue and they want to try to solve it as well.
And it's interesting because it's a requirement. The state has to provide the documentation. So it leaves you thinking, if you're required to provide it, it's interesting that you're not required to provide results.
You spoke to a number of young people who are in this situation, and we're going to hear these stories next week on the Texas Standard, but can you give me a little preview of one of these people?
Yeah, I think one of the stories that better illustrates the challenges of pursuing your documents while you're in the system is the story of a young man. He goes by the name of CJ, and CJ's story is just very tragic, as you can imagine. He was born in Hawaii. His parents were not married to each other, but his mother was married to a different person. And so this person came to Hawaii, shot his wife, shot the man who was CJ's father. Wow. And CJ was just a few months old. And you would think, wow, that's tragic enough. But his father was left wheelchair bound and was killed in a hit-and-run accident when CJ was 5 years old. He came to Austin to be with relatives, and there he suffered from abuse. So you're thinking, this is super difficult, a really difficult situation, because he was born out of state. He didn't have his documents with him. He came here, and there was abuse in his family environment. There was an organization, Partnerships for Children, that was able to help him find his documents, track that birth certificate. Just the story of how they got the birth certificate, they put it together succinctly by saying, you know, it took two people more than 50 phone calls to Hawaii and a state senator to be able to get that birth certificate. And you wonder, you know, if a child ages out without that network of somebody who can dedicate the time to make 50 phone calls, somebody who can reach out to a state senator, can you get your birth certificate?
And DFPS even told us, you know, when we asked what are some of the challenges they face in getting birth certificates, I mean, the top thing they said was when a child is born out of state, because there aren't cooperative agreements between states. And they said sometimes it takes a court order to be able to get a birth certificate from another state when a child is now in Texas and needs that original document.
What are some of the measures being proposed during this legislative session at the state capitol to address this problem?
Two lawmakers have actually jointly introduced a bill in the Texas House. It's HB 123. And the idea behind that, it's a bill that is targeted at foster youth, homeless children, and unaccompanied minors. And the idea is to make it easier for them to access ID, whether that's, you know, waiving a fee they might have to pay to get a driver's license, or finding an alternative if they don't have a permanent address, allowing another address to substitute for a permanent address so that they're able to access identification.
If anyone listening knows someone who's in this situation, aging out of foster care without the proper documentation, what would you tell them to do?
I would tell them to contact the Texas Foster Youth Justice Project. There's a group of attorneys. It's a small group, but there's a group of attorneys that is dedicated to helping children track down their documents. They do it free of charge, and they do it statewide.
Joy Diaz and Becky Fogel are reporters for the Texas Standard, and you can hear their series next week, Unidentified, How Kids Can Age Out of Texas Foster Care Without Documentation. Catch the Texas Standard weekdays from 10 to 11 here on KUT or at texasstandard.org. Joy, Becky, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you. Thank you.
When you live in a state with the largest share of people without health insurance in the country, it's not uncommon to hear about people finding themselves in pretty desperate situations to get health care. But even by that standard, the story of Edward Averill really stands out. Last year, he robbed a bank in Austin so he could get arrested and get health care in jail. Reporter Kira O'Rourke spent months speaking with Averill, and now she has a story published at The Atavist Magazine. You can read it at magazine.atavist.com. Kira, thank you for coming into KUT.
Thanks for having me.
When did you first hear about the story of Edward Averill?
I heard about it not long after he committed the crime. A few days later, the Austin American-Statesman had run a short story about what had happened, and citing the arrest affidavit, noted that Ed, as he goes by, had committed the crime because he wanted health care. And that was fascinating to me, and I reached out to him to find out more.
In the piece, you go a lot into his background, and I feel like we need to hear a little bit about that to understand how he wound up robbing this bank. Can you describe the downward descent of his health?
Sure. So Ed traveled around the country a lot, both growing up and then to a lesser extent as an adult. He was a contract computer engineer, and so he had a lot of flexibility. He worked contract jobs, sometimes had health insurance, sometimes didn't. At some point, he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And then more recently, in 2017-18, his health started to slip further. He had a foot amputated, a complication of his diabetes, and he had an infection that he had to deal with. At some point, his prosthesis that he used to walk stopped fitting. He woke up one morning with what looked like blood in his eyesight, and he went to the doctor and realized that he had a problem with his retina, and he also, the doctor detected, had a stroke that went undetected previously. And he felt lost and like he didn't know what to do and didn't have anywhere to turn. He didn't have insurance at the time. He was between jobs, but because his eyesight was impaired, he couldn't get a new job and he was running out of money.
He had also suffered some pretty painful emotional loss in his life, which maybe contributed to his health problems in a way.
Yeah. Years earlier, a really dear friend of his died and it devastated him and it caused him such pain that he felt like he could never experience that again. And he very purposefully started to cut himself off from people in his life. He stopped accepting invitations to go out. He started to cut himself off from people that he had met in online forums. He spent a lot of time on the internet. And eventually he had accomplished his mission and he was very much alone, or as alone as he could be.
At what point did Ed Averill decide to rob a bank so he could get health care?
He settled on the plan a few weeks before the robbery, which happened in April 2018. And he stumbled upon an article that he said happened in the Pacific Northwest years and years ago. And it sounded like a homeless man had robbed a bank to get health care, and he was getting pretty good care in jail. Ed was shocked, but then thought, you know, maybe this could work for me. So he started to research what happened when somebody robs a bank. He tried to figure out what he needed to do to cause the least harm. He was concerned with trying not to traumatize people, to seem polite. That's why he included the word thanks on the note that he ultimately passed to the bank teller, because he didn't want them to think that he was some maniac holding them up, potentially trying to injure them. He wasn't armed. And then he told them to call the police, and he went outside and he sat down on the curb and waited for the cops to come.
What was the bank that he tried to rob?
Prosperity Bank.
Where?
It was a branch in Northwest Austin.
How did he feel when he was finally behind bars?
He was relieved. He was finally somewhere safer, safer than he had felt. So he had somewhere to sleep. He had food. He had medication. The county took him to get an eye surgery, even though it did not repair his vision. He's still today waiting for something that will fix cataracts, which were discovered along the way. But he was able to some extent, get the health care that he was seeking. And in some ways, that vindicated him, or at least he felt like it did for a while.
Felt like it did for a while. So what changed?
He wanted to go to federal prison. He didn't want to go to jail. He realized that he had to go to jail pending trial, but he had read that federal prison has better health care benefits than jails do. But the FBI wasn't interested in this case. And so, though Ed had been under the impression that it's automatically a federal charge, it's not. So it stayed as a local issue, and the lawyer appointed to Ed's case was working with prosecutors to find a solution, because for everyone involved, except for Ed, they didn't want to see somebody sent to prison for committing a crime to get health care. At the same time, they were wary of copycats, that they wouldn't want others to see Ed's story the way Ed saw someone else's story and then commit the same crime.
Ultimately, he got released from jail. And then what did he do to try to get arrested again?
He didn't want to be released from jail, but he felt like things were happening. It seemed like the people working on his case, his lawyer, social workers who had been tapped to help, were trying to find him housing, trying to find him a more permanent solution. So he relatively gamely went along with his release, and he was dropped off at the Arch. And when he got there, he felt like what he had heard from some of his cellmates in jail, that you don't want to wind up at the Arch, was true. So he learned that he wouldn't get what was called a medical mat. He wouldn't be able to see a doctor for days. And he decided, well, that's not going to work for me. So he went over to the window and took the cane that he used to help him walk and started hitting it. His aim was to get rearrested, but it didn't work. Ultimately, the police officer who responded to that situation decided to take him to the Herman Center, which helps people who are having a mental health crisis.
What's happening with Ed Averill now?
Ed was lucky that happened, because that then funneled him into the kind of care and assistance that he needed, that he maybe wouldn't have gotten through the criminal justice system otherwise. He was then hooked up to social workers and case managers who were able to help him qualify ultimately for Social Security, and he's now receiving enough money to live. He has money to pay for a caretaker who visits him twice a week now. He has money for food, he has money for rent, and though his vision isn't well enough yet that he's able to work, he's able to survive.
You point out in your piece that he could be a line in a politician's stump speech. The man who robbed a bank to get health care. Does he want to be that line in a politician's stump speech?
He really wants his story to help someone. So that was what inspired his honesty, that he wanted to lay it all out there and maybe somebody else would feel less alone or like they were without help or that help was out of reach.
Kira O'Rourke is a reporter who has written about the story of Ed Averill, a man who robbed a bank in Austin so he could get arrested and get health care in jail. You can read it at magazine.atavist.com. It's called Desperado. It is a moving story, Kira.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for coming in and talking about it.
Thanks for having me.
That is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of February 2019. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶